Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Steve Romanin, joined once again by our tech and training, Billy Warens. Say hi, Billy.
Oh, hey, how's everybody doing?
I wanted to get Billy on the mic because I know it's kind of a scary first experience. So I'm going to ask him a question that he asked me when we first met. So, Billy, what's the craziest thing you've ever done?
The craziest thing I've ever done. Let's see. I think that would be me climbing a few buildings. I like to climb buildings as a hobby sometimes, not often, but
yeah. I've been thinking about, like, have you gotten arrested before?
No, never.
Not yet.
I'm like a night prowler. I don't get caught.
Well, don't wear any reflective gear.
Nope.
We have a fantastic show lined up for you today. On Sunday, Lauren interviewed Jason Reibel, a historian and author whose new book, Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance, was just released last month. It's a really interesting book, and it's a really fantastic interview, so definitely stay tuned for that. As well, next week we have an interview with photographer and documentary filmmaker Vanessa Schultz of 21st Paradigm. Her newest film, Lost Dogs, explores the problem of street dogs in Chile. And pending a shortage of funds, should hopefully see release soon. So be sure to tune in for that next week. First, though, we have some news, some depressing news from last Wednesday. From the Globe and Mail, deal lets Canada sell seal products in China. After years of battling Europeans, pop stars, and animal rights activists over the controversial seal hunt, Canadian officials think they have finally found a more receptive market for seal products. China. On Wednesday, Fisheries Minister Gail Xie signed a cooperative arrangement with Chinese officials that said she will give Canada's sealing industry access to the world's largest consumer market. Perhaps fittingly, this deal was signed while Ms. Xie and a group of Canadian business people were attending the China Fur and Leather Products Fair in Beijing. Needless to say, there were no fur protesters in sight. The agreement, quote, will allow the export of edible seal products from Canada, such as meat and oil, to China, Ms. Xie said. For Canada, sealing is about more than fur. The trade of other seal products, such as oils and meat, represents a growing share of what is already a multi-million dollar business. Canadian officials have spent years wooing the Chinese. Ms. Xie's discussions began during last year's Beijing Fur Show. Many Canadian politicians and industry players believe Chinese consumers are open to wearing sealskin and eating seal meat. They also hope that Chinese purchases will revive Canada's sealing industry, which has been hit hard by a ban on many seal products imposed last year by the European Union. The ban has helped drive down prices for seal pelts, which sank to $19 on average last year at some major auctions, from $38 in 2009 and $56 in 2008. Pelts went for as much as $76 on average in 2006. The number of seals harvested annually has also fallen steadily, dropping to fewer than 70,000 last year, from about 300,000 in 2005. Only about 6,000 people derive some income from seal hunting, and total exports are roughly $10 million annually. Animal rights activists claim the industry is on its last legs, and they are vowing to take the anti-seal hunt campaign to China. Chinese people care just as much about animals as the citizens of Europe and America, said Liu Dai, director of China Small Animal Protection Association, in a statement Wednesday. Quote, my organization and many others will work to ensure China never becomes a significant market for Canadian seal products. Cheryl Fink, director of the seal program at the International Fund for Animal Welfare in Toronto, said Canadian officials are wrong to think that they can count on Chinese consumers to buy seal products. Quote, this general attitude that we can dump the products that the rest of the world doesn't want on China because of the sense that they have a lack of understanding of animal welfare or think that they won't care about the cruelty in the seal hunt, I think that's a bit insulting, Ms. Fink said, adding, it's along the lines of the way that we dump our asbestos on the rest of the world. Europe doesn't want our seal products. Canadians, by and large, don't consume seal products, and on a large scale, and now they're turning to China and with this attitude that they'll take it or they'll take anything. But Ms. Xie's announcement won praise from an Inuit group that is spearheading a challenge on the EU ban in a European court. Quote, the size of the Chinese market and rapid growth of the Chinese economy makes this particularly good news for Inuit and our interest in expanding our market opportunities for sealskin products, said Mary Simon, president of the Inuit Tapirit Kanatami, a national Inuit organization. Quote, I'm pleased that the Chinese government has seen through the myths and distortions that have been so widely disseminated by animal rights extremists in other parts of the world, such as Europe. We want to create a stable and secure future for our seal hunters. And that's all the news that, frankly, I can handle for this week. So we're going to turn it over to Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement now, and we'll come back with the interview with Jason Reibel right here on Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Stay tuned.
Greetings, Animal Voices. It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. This week I have a song from Consolidated. They were a U.S. radical activist recording and performing group formed in 1988 and best known in the early 1990s as an alternative dance industrial music band. They were distinguished by left-leaning political activism and politically radical lyrics, as well as their innovative sonic collages, which blended industrial and hip-hop styles. This song is called Unity of Oppression.
Song, but the facts, we gotta face it. Men rape women and man rapes the environment, and people with opposed religious views are violent. How can we advance with a memory so short? We live in a society that kills animals for sport. And how can we discuss gender, class, or race when we can't respect the rights of lesbians and gays?
Racism, homophobia, xenophobia.
To make a difference, we specialize. When the contradiction arises, we fail to realize the damage is done to the Native American. These singular issues I just can't understand. How you can love one and have hatred for another. You torture your sisters while saying peace to your brothers. As long as we insist on being so aggressive, we will continue to play the role of the oppressor. When men and women, straight and gay, whites and non-whites begin to unite. When humans can treat non-human species with fairness and dignity, then, only then, is there unity.
Oppression.
We got to understand the concept of unity.
Oppression.
Make us all a fight for the price of unity. We got to understand the concept of unity.
Oppression.
To all the white liberals and non-white militants that oversimplify the impact of prejudice, blame it on the whites and you're right, but it keeps us divided. That agenda becomes short-sighted. I hear you condemning all racist sentiments, and then I hear you making anti-Semitic comments. Instead of only allowing one type of equality, place the blame on each other. Yet we should be expanding our scope of understanding and hope, just posing some questions and make some suggestions. We don't claim to speak from a position of authority. We only want one thing, and that's unity.
We'll be right back. as mirror and representation of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death, one which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people. The disempowering of women. It takes the notion of objectification one step further. Not only have we objectified animals, but in objectifying them, we take what we want from them and leave the rest out. We leave their death out and we take their bodies. We leave the images of their death out, but take the meaning of meat and apply it to women. Apply it to women.
The song that you just heard is called The Sexual Politics of Meat, featuring none other than Carol J. Adams, the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat. So please be sure and check out more from Consolidated and other vegan hip-hop artists on the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement Blogspot, Facebook, and MySpace pages.
Big thanks to Kevin Tillman again, and as usual, we are going to continue into our interview with Jason Reibel right after a quick break here.
Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Steve Romanen, doing the technical work for us today. I'm very pleased to welcome to the program Jason Reibel. He has a new book out called Fear of the Animal Planet, The Hidden History of Animal Resistance. You might recognize Jason's work from past articles that he's published, such as Animals, Agency, and Class, Jesse, a Working Dog, and Animals Are Part of the Working Class. He's published a lot of pieces through Counterpunch, and Counterpunch also is the publisher of the book Fear of the Animal Planet. And to kick things off, Jason, I wanted to hear about how you got interested in tackling this topic, which is about looking at how animals are agents of historical change and how they've been resistors throughout history.
Sure. It was 1998, so some time ago, and I just started working on my doctorate, and I had to do a seminar paper for a class, and I was in Toledo, Ohio, and Toledo has a somewhat famous zoo, so I thought I would just do some paper on the zoo. And at the time, I had no real interest in animals whatsoever. I'm not really even an animal lover, and then I was fairly indifferent. So it was going to be a standard zoo history. But as I was researching, I kept on coming across all of these examples of animals escaping, animals attacking again and again. And so this started really kind of challenging my thinking and changing the directions of where I was going. And it was from that I would go on to really do my dissertation and become an historian of other animals. And it would make me become a vegetarian and would force me to become supportive of animal rights. So it completely really changed the direction of my life.
What brought you to history initially?
Well, I really wanted to study with Peter Linebaugh, who's somewhat of a famous historian who worked with E.P. Thompson, and I wanted to learn the methodology of history from below. And so it was kind of the combination of those two things, of seeing all these oddities in the historical records of studying the zoo and studying this methodology of history from below, that they just kind of came together. And so that really just forced me to change everything of the way I was looking at stuff.
It's interesting that you were willing to shift away from a anthropocentric or homocentric view, because when people think about a history from below, they're typically thinking about things like peasant uprisings or some of the stories and narratives that get left out of the mainstream historical record, which is everyday people and their lives and how they live their lives and the types of resistance and the types of activities that they're engaged with. I think it's interesting that you are willing to give credence to or give weight to these animal stories in a way that wouldn't just disregard them in the typical fashion of the media, which is to say that they're just sort of accidents or they're just acting out of sort of instinctual behavior, but you were willing to actually put them in the framework of a history from below.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much just happenstance that it would occur this way. If not, I would have probably written my dissertation about something far different. But as I guess I said, I was studying the zoo and I started seeing all these examples, and it just really piqued my interest.
So what does that mean then for you, a history from below?
Well, it's a general definition of studying the ways in which normal everyday people and other animals can affect and create history by themselves through their own initiatives, through their own agency, if you like.
And one of your teachers, Peter Linebaugh, was he open to your direction?
Yes, he was. So that was very pleasant. Not a lot of teachers would be. But he's very open-minded. So it kind of comes from that tradition where you can start accepting different views, and a lot of times history from below can be that way.
So did your work find immediate resonance, resonance in other literatures? Did you find similar people that were doing work in the field of animal rights that were interested in animal agency, or other historians that were willing to entertain the idea of animals agency in a history from below that would include and show prominently animals agency?
No, not really. I mean, at the time, which was before 2000, animal studies really, just as a discipline, was just beginning. And I had no contact with them. And the way that I was studying history and the way I was being taught is that you look at the primary sources first. So I didn't even get to any of the secondary sources pretty much until I finished my dissertation. So it was kind of a different approach. Today, you know, things have changed markedly. But then it was pretty just by myself.
I think there's a tendency, which makes sense, I think, although I agree it seems like it's changing, but there's a tendency, I think, within some of the animal rights literature to really position animals as strictly as victims. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit about why this is an important shift, to not just see them in this sort of role of the victim, this perpetual victim.
Well, for me, it's more of a question of solidarity. So how it affected me. So I'm studying zoos. I could care less about other animals. And I'm seeing all these acts of resistance, and it actually moved me so much that I would dedicate the rest of my life to become an historian of other animals, which is not exactly a job-getting market, and become a vegetarian, develop an interest in animal rights, which did not exist before. I grew up in the Midwest, and it was all about eating meat. So it was a pretty radical shift for me. And so for me, I think, at least the direction that I'm taking, is that with the book, with my ideas, I'm trying to let ordinary people into this world that they can see, they can begin to understand, and that they can begin to develop some solidarity with the creatures behind the bars.
Can you give us some examples then that stand out for you? I mean, there's so many stories, fantastic stories in Fear of the Animal Planet. Can you highlight some that, for people who've never heard of your work before, that stand out for you?
Sure. Just last February, as everybody knows, it was Tilikum, the SeaWorld orca, who drowned her trainer. And that made really big news. And from events like that, you can begin to see shifts in people's attitudes. So from that, people begin to develop interest. Some people begin to develop sympathy. Some people begin to see the orcas slightly differently, not so much as a victim, but more as someone who is giving their own intent, their own purpose, their own desires for freedom. More recently, which would be this past Friday, there was Eddie, the elephant in the Knoxville Zoo, who pushed her trainer against the steel bars of her enclosure and crushed the woman to death. The zoo, of course, naturally, right away, said that it was an accident, but we know that from the evidence that's already come out, that she was in front of the elephant. So, could elephants really smash someone with their head and not know what they're doing? I highly doubt it. So what we'll see come from this one, I don't know, but it's continuous. So then Saturday, the day after, two chimpanzees at a zoo in Nebraska attacked the keeper. So, it's continuous. I have a hard time keeping up with it, actually, keeping a record at all.
Well, it runs so counter to what you flag at the beginning of the book is one of the typical responses of zoos when there is an attack or there's an escape is to really minimize it and to say that this is very rare, to make it seem like an isolated event. And one of the things that becomes so clear in Fear of the Animal Planet, your book, is that it's really this, as you said, it's this kind of continual deluge of incident after incident after incident.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. I have boxes of material, a lot of which I never used because it was just too much and people would get bored. I wanted to write this book for a general reader, my parents, somebody that has no interest, can't read, really academic writing. So it has to be short. It has to be a narrative, storytelling, and it has to be to the point. And so that's really what I was trying to do.
One of the critiques that you also point to at the beginning of the book, or one of the things that is sometimes raised as a concern, is whether or not we can attribute intention to these forms of resistance that, as you're naming them as such. And I'm wondering if you can kind of map out for us about how we know that the animals are actually resisting as opposed to what some people might just say is, they're just acting in these, the wild animals that they are. This is sort of this sort of stimulus response, instinctual stuff that... some past philosophers and others have put forward.
Yeah. Well, every captive animal knows through years of direct experience and learned response which actions will be rewarded and which actions will be punished. So elephants, for instance, most of them are trained with bullhooks, right? If they do something wrong, they get hit repeatedly or stabbed with the barbed end to correct those actions so that they don't do them again. So really, it's against their own self-interest be disobedient in any way, because who wants to get hit? I don't like getting hit with a big stick, and I'm sure you would or no one else. Yet history is filled with cases of captive elephants doing just that, continually refusing commands or purposely injuring trainers even though they're going to get beaten, and then they do, and they get back out again, and then they do it again. So if it's against your own interests, if you're doing it again and again and again, that's why I say these are acts of resistance, because these animals are struggling against their captivity and against domination. I have a difficult time seeing it in any other way when you look at it with this huge body. One of the problems is that people look at it just in isolation. So they just see one little piece and they say, but I doubt it. Then they see again and then again and then again. They see particular animals doing it again and again and again, knowing that after something happens, something bad happens to the creature, and yet they make the conscious choice of repeating it again, even though something bad is going to happen to them.
I think that the example, I believe the elephant's name was Janet, mm-hmm. that story is, I found really compelling, and of course, like when I was reading many of the stories, I felt very inspired and also very angry. But one of the things that surprised me about Janet's story is I actually got quite emotionally choked up, because there's a part of the story, and maybe you can recount it for us, but there's a part of the story where she's seeking out individuals who have harmed her in the midst of a crowd where she could have certainly gone after random others. And she actually had children on her back, and she allows them to be removed, but she also at one point is smashing the bullhook as well. And it was that kind of violence directed towards the instrument of her domination and abuse really had an emotional impact on me.
Yeah, that's something that stuck with me. You know, with all these captive elephants, you would think that they could cause mass chaos. They could cause mass death. They could just plow through people and crowds and such. But since there's been circuses and zoos dating back into the 1800s to the present day, I had a very difficult time finding any cases where elephants actually did that. Usually they always target particular people. So they're particular trainers or grooms or even clowns from the circus. And they'll pick these people out of crowds, tents or in their buildings or outside of the buildings, and they'll go after just them. And a lot of times these elephants are carrying children on their back. And yet again, I could not find any instances where they chuck the children off, which they could have easily done. Instead, they go on their little rampage, they go after particular people, and yet they still how keep the children in balance on their back. It seems to me pretty remarkable. In the case of Janet, she did this, chasing out of the circus tent, and then into the fairway, and then eventually she stopped, they got the children off, and they were going to put her in a trailer. Well, she plowed under two more of the trainers, and then she actually picked up the bullhook with her trunk and was smashing it against the side of the trailer, which is, you know, remarkable. And then she took off again. And then eventually she would be met by the police and be shot to death.
This is a common end to a lot of these stories where the animals have resisted. Sometimes they're killed, sometimes they're brought back. You make the point too, I think, in the section on orcas, that there's some acknowledgement that even when these animals are dangerous, that they're good for business. There's a huge investment in them as laborers. It just seems really unfortunate, though, and I guess historically it is actually there's other precedents of when animals commit what is sometimes called as crimes, that they're punished with death. Of course, we don't allow them to go through a kind of trial process as we did maybe at some points in history, but it seems so egregiously unfair not only to experience the treatment, but then when to fight back, that you're met with bullets and killed often.
Yeah, in the case of many of these creatures, their resistance always comes in steps. They'll let you know that they're angry at first. They'll disobeying commands. So in the case of Tillicum, the show previous to the one where he killed a drowned trainer, they were refusing to perform tricks, including him. And the trainers actually said on the loudspeaker to the audience, you know, that the orcas were having a bad day and that they were being ornery and disobedient. Well, that should have been a clue to the trainers not to do another show. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So they did, and this event, you know, where he drowned the trainer happened. In the case of elephants, the same way. Usually you'll see some refusals to obey commands, and then the trainers will start whacking the elephants with bullhooks, and then you'll start seeing more violent reprisals. Sometimes they'll just take the stage of pushes and shoves, or in the case, they'll kill a trainer and then act fairly calmly afterwards, just kind of walk away. But then there's another step after that, where they will just, that'll be it. And I'm pretty certain, given that how intelligent elephants are, that they know that that's probably going to be it for them. And we've had a lot of cases like that, where the elephants have had enough, they've shown their anger, it has been not accepted or responded to, and so they go past a certain limit, and then that's that. Sometimes they used to be executed. Elephants have been hung, firing squads, poisonings. Today, because of animal rights groups, circuses and zoos can't really get away with that too easily, so they'll usually just ship them out, often to other circuses and zoos, or in the case of certain animals, to the black market.
Yeah, can you talk more about that? I know that one of your major references that you draw on is, I believe it's a book called Underworld.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking, and I think another book came out recently about the same topic, about the underground trade. So all circuses and zoos, even like the biggest ones, will dump animals. When they get sick of them, or if the animals are particularly resistant, they sell them to middlemen who are licensed, who then sell them to anyone and everyone. So hunting preserves, you know, for canned hunting operations, or exotic meat restaurants, or, you know, God knows what else. So it's very prevalent. And that includes endangered species as well.
And some of those animals then are going to research labs as well?
Yeah, they can go anywhere. We have many cases of zoos shipping monkeys to research labs, selling them.
You talk a lot about animals in zoos and other in aquariums, places of captivity, but you also talk about acts of resistance that happen within labs, which is also something that I found quite eye-opening and shocking. Again, just highlighting how terrible those conditions are. And I was wondering if you could tell us some of those stories about monkeys or chimpanzees or other animals within research facilities and some of their stories of resistance.
Sure. I mean, most labs have had this happen. It's always behind closed doors, and it's very difficult to glean information from this. But when we do get them, it's pretty surprising. There's a research lab in Tulane that has had this series of monkeys escaping off their ground. And they always say, oh, they're just breeding. It's a breeding colony, so they don't have any diseases. But then residents will see the men out there, or the women with their big suits on. So, you know, they're never that confident. Because these labs test on the nasty viruses and bacteria and probably germ warfare stuff. And these creatures are constantly escaping. And then within the labs themselves, they're constantly biting, scratching lab workers. So that when they do particular surveys, they'll find lab workers with all these different interesting diseases, and all of them came from monkeys biting their arms and legs, or throwing fluids to the screens, because every time there's an act of resistance on the part of the animals, there's counteractions by the zoos or circuses or laboratories to prevent that resistance from occurring again. So in the case of laboratories, they put finely meshed screens so that they can never reach their little hands through to grab a hold of you, but they can still throw things. So there's been a case of one lab worker dying from virus B, from getting it hit in the face.
And that was either through spit or through urine that was thrown?
I don't know. All I know is that she got hit with something, so it had to have been a fluid.
Hmm.
Well, none of us are without weapons, and sometimes that takes the form of our own poo.
Hmm. They're quite incredible stories, and the ones from the labs, too, it's not just one or two animals that are sometimes escaping. We're talking about, at times, dozens, or I think there was even an escape that you mentioned that was at least 100 animals?
Yeah, Tulane facility has had multiple escapes, and they're mass escapes, so it isn't just a few animals, it's just a whole ton. And the news is really hard to get, so they'll say, oh, we captured most. Okay. And then I never hear anything more. I can't find any more information about it. So do these animals escape for good? There's a good chance, because throughout the United States, monkeys will just show up out of nowhere. And usually circuses and zoos will say when an animal escapes, and they'll really press hard to get that particular creature back. And even pet owners will do the same. But then there's just, you know, strange monkeys showing up in the trees outside your window, and it's really kind of odd.
Can you tell us about Alfie?
Alfie, yes. It was in the 80s, and he's a monkey, escaped from the Pittsburgh Zoo. And some of the monkeys, they like using, there was a thunderstorm, a fallen limb fell into the pit. They're smart. They used the fallen limb as a bridge to get out of there. A couple were captured, but he made it over the walls and through Pittsburgh somehow, because this is like in the center of Pittsburgh, made it across bridges, busy bridges, and just started showing up along the way into West Virginia and then eventually into Ohio. He traveled several hundred miles, and for, I think it was about a month, and they kept on trying to catch him along the way, but he was always smarter. Often monkey can outsmart man. And in this case, he did. He was eventually captured. The zoo really put an extraordinary amount of effort into getting him back to, I don't know why, I guess to save face. But then he was brought back, and he was actually, he gained weight on his journey, which I found to be kind of amusing, because they always say that, you know, there's no way that other animals can survive. You know, we feed them, we give them shelter, and then somehow they always do.
You mentioned him gaining weight, which reminds me of another story and something that also had a huge impact on me when I read it. I believe this was a tiger. I'm not sure if this was Tatiana, a tiger that had been, it looks like, intentionally given, I believe, 10 pounds less meat. Was it a day? In order that she would be more performative or there would be more activity. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that was at the San Francisco Zoo, and it was, that came out after the attack. So the attack happened, it was Christmas Day, 2007, and I was living in San Francisco at the time, and it made pretty large news. Some teenagers had been teasing the lions and then off to the tigers, and she managed to make it over the wall and went after them in particular. But in any case, after the fact, we always get more evidence. And this is always something interesting to me as an historian, because you see the event, and then the next couple of days, more information comes leaking out, and then more and then more. And in the case of this particular tiger, we found out that she had been fed 10 pounds less meat at least feeding. And there's always suspicions on why they might do this. They said, of course, that she was, I think, overweight or not the correct weight. But this can also be used as a means to create more activity, because a tiger just lying in the cage is not very interesting for visitors. They want to see activity. So there's always suspicion that zoos are doing such things, including using pharmaceutical drugs.
I think it's appropriate that AK Press is the publisher, I believe, of this book.
Yeah, it's along with Counterpunch.
It's the Shrew Counterpunch. And then AK Press is also involved?
I think they're the main distributors.
Okay. Because as I was reading through this, the theme that kept coming to the surface for me was around capitalism and critiques of capitalism and economics that so often I find with my own work where I've looked at slaughterhouses quite a bit, and factory farms, is that one of the common rhetorical responses is to say that if animals are being hurt, to say that that can't be the case because farmers have an interest in treating the animals well, because that will lead to a productive animal, which is, you know, seen as a happier animal because they're producing, and that just makes economic sense for the farmers. And I believe to probably some extent people will think the same thing about zoos, just within sort of the logic of capitalism, that there's this notion that when we have animals in these conditions of domination, of exploitation, that somehow people have an interest in treating them well in order to get them to do what they want. And it becomes very clear through this book that there's actually all sorts of economic incentives not to treat animals well within these conditions.
Yeah, most creatures are trained, whether they be in circuses where they have to perform, or even in zoos where they're not particularly supposed to, that they're always using very aggressive methods, usually violent, of keeping these animals in check, whether it be whips or bullhooks or sticks, electrical prods, all sorts of crazy things that they use. I mean, one place, Hawthorne, which is what used to be a major dealer outside of Chicago, and leasing exotic animals to circuses, zoos, fairs, or what have you. There was an attack there, a tiger attacked a visitor at their main facility, and they beat the tiger off with baseball bats. So that's something I didn't know they used as a tool.
I think it's a really powerful argumentative strategy. Obviously, it's very weak, but people will say things like, zoos are important for conservation and education as being sort of the, I guess, the most common thing that you'll hear about zoos and defenders of zoos, and that actually zoos will, as you point out in the book, will kind of trot out this little bit of propaganda when there is an escape in order to justify the continuation of the zoo. And I imagine that some people listening would imagine that there could be a more humane version of a zoo that maybe wouldn't lead to these forms of resistance and maybe could make the animals happier. Could you respond to that for us? Is the point of this to say we should be treating animals better, or do you think that there is, or are you aiming for abolition of captivity for animals altogether?
Well, the first thing that you should address when you get those kind of questions is conservation and education true with zoos and circuses? This has been talked about before, but when you look at the traveling hunter books of expeditions in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they were very popular and numerous, and you see the sheer numbers of creatures being killed in Africa, Asia, or anywhere. It's shocking. As zoos, really, up until the 1980s, and they've missed this on their record, they considered animals to be expendable. So if they just died, you just get some new ones from whatever country. It doesn't matter. So first off, they're directly responsible for this near extinction or extinction of the species across the globe. They, together with natural history museums. And remember, they're always killing the mothers and taking the children, because adults are too aggressive and resistant, so they think the children are easier to shift and keep and raise. And what that does to the population, I can only imagine. So that's the first point. And also, what has resulted from the conservation methods? So tigers in the wild, there's, less than 3,000? And in the United States alone, there's over 15,000 tigers, whether it be in zoos or in people's backyards as pets. So that's kind of what zoos have gotten us, this model, where tigers are almost functionally extinct. Yet, they exist everywhere in people's backyards or in zoos in an overpopulation here in the United States. So to me, it's kind of insane. And in terms of education, there's really not a lot of evidence that people learn anything in museums, and these are lumped together with them. The definitive study was done in the mid-90s. It's called Paying Attention. And it showed that regardless of the budget and regardless how large or small a museum or a zoo or an aquarium is, people aren't paying attention. They fly through at astronomic rates. If there's an exit sign, it's like a black hole sucking people out. So people are only going to these places really to be entertained. So there's very little education that's even going on in these institutions. So for me, in terms of conservation, in terms of education, we can do better. Zoos have been around for over 100 years, and things have never really been worse in terms of ecology in the world. So for me, it's time to change the strategy and do something different.
So as a general argument, though, against captivity, what would you say? You speak about the lack of autonomy that these animals have, certainly a shrinkage of their natural wild ranges. But why shouldn't we keep animals in captivity?
Well, again, I don't really necessarily see the purpose, because for zoos and circuses, they have a very exploitative relationship. It isn't a family-based relationship that you might have with a dog or a cat living in your house, because you're both sharing the same abode. I'm not saying family relationships are necessarily the greatest, but they're better than what occurs in these institutions. So for me, the solution is really to do something just radically different, and that is preserving the land that still exists, and the territories, the areas that still exist in the world, and putting all of your focus there. You know, for the creatures that still live in zoos and circuses, sanctuaries look to be like the best options. And in some cases, release back into wherever they might have come from and spending the money that way. I mean, you look at Tulikum, and I tried to look at the books of SeaWorld, and it's all very hidden away, but some of the numbers exist. And I figured out that Tulikum, in his years at SeaWorld, the amount of money he brought in was probably close to $1 billion. Because remember, he's their main stud. Hmm. So he's in a lot of orcas for them and makes mainly the most money for whatever company at the time owns them. And so I think, it sounds reasonable to me. If you do your work, you should get something for it, and Talib certainly deserves to retire because he's not going to live that much longer. He's already pushing 30, and they don't usually last much beyond that in captivity. And so some of that money, because we have elephant sanctuaries in Tennessee and California, that I'm sure the good people of Vancouver or Washington would gladly open up a bay to have a little retirement facility for orcas. Mm. That to me sounds reasonable.
Do some people think that the stories that you tell are focusing on exceptional animals? So, for example, it always seems that whenever there's any kind of an escape from a slaughterhouse, that people will scramble to have that particular cow or calf saved and brought into a sanctuary. And there's this notion in the rhetoric always really bugs me, because people will say, well, she earned it. She earned her freedom. So this notion that she's kind of this exception. And one of the things that stood out for me from the book is that there were so often stories of collaboration between animals, too. It really isn't just this exceptional, highly intelligent elephant was able to outsmart a particular institution or a group of owners, but you have animals sort of more typically working together to figure out how to get out.
Yeah, especially in the case of primates. But with other animals too, a case of, let's say, elephants, I found like those two particular ones in a section of the book about them. They would kind of start little fights, and they would use that as an opportunity to kind of rip a place apart. Because a lot of times I would see in the research kind of fights between elephants, and then that would just kind of end right there. But these two, they always kind of seemed to use it, and they were split up on purpose of this. And then in the case of primates, there's always just tons and tons of cooperation and organization to figure out how to get out of a place.
Well, some people just say that they're just curious. They're just doing things to get out not because they're really unhappy there, but just for something to do or just to see if they can outsmart their captors.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they are doing that, partially, trying to entertain themselves in some way, because it's quite boring living in a cell. But yeah, a lot of these times they do it again and again and again. I was reading something in Time magazine a couple days ago, and they had the top 10 animal escapes, and they're talking about Ken Allen, the orangutan, and they put this little quote in there from the zoo saying, or no, it wasn't even a quote, about how Ken Allen was always happy when he was eventually caught and came back without putting up a fight, which is completely a lie. It's not true at all. He did struggle. And in the case of his last escape, he put up a major struggle. It took him hours to get him down the cell, and God knows what they did to him to accomplish that.
Why do you think there's such a reluctance to attribute any kind of agency and intention to these kinds of acts? Like, what does this mean for us? Why are we so unwilling to acknowledge it?
Well, I'd say some of it has to do with human superiority. We, like with Michael Vick and the dogs, and a lot of people were very upset at Michael Vick. But then they would only get to a point where they said, I don't know if dogs should have this many rights or be equal footing with ourselves. And to me, it kind of seems the same way. They don't want to lose their status as, the great human and being superior in every way and being able to be outsmarted by a monkey or what have you. And in the case of zoos and circuses and aquariums, they want to be the hero. And when these creatures have an historian, as the African proverb goes, they're not the hero anymore. Mm. And people are going to switch sides. In the case of myself, that's what happened. So I don't think they want that. And in a lot of cases, the case of the aquarium in Victoria, after the 1991 attack, drowning the first trainer, they got shut down. They could not withstand the negative publicity that came from that. SeaWorld, in 1987, there was an attack, and that one almost shut them down. I mean, they had to fire every executive to stay afloat. So these attacks can have multiple effects on multiple levels, from how the general public sees what's going on there, and even to their own operations and profitability.
I know that we're probably running out of time, but I wanted to turn it over to you if there's any major points or some stories that you wanted to touch on. Again, for me, I mean, some of the things that really struck me were you talk a lot about how there's a lot of planning involved sometimes, and also that these animals can be very strategic about exploiting or taking advantage of human vulnerabilities, and that's something that stood out for me. But I don't know if you want to tell a story related to that or something else or another point from the book.
Well, with Ken Allen, it's just amazing the intelligence and how the zoo people would dress up in costumes like tourists to try to outwit him. There was Chuni the elephant in early 19th century London who they were trying to execute him for his continued resistance, and they would try to give him hot buns filled with poison, and he would sort through the ones, smell them, and figure out which ones had the poison, which didn't, and then shift the other ones away. You know, then they'd bring in some like unknown tourists to do the same, and it never worked. You know, they're able to outwit us more than we ever like to admit.
You've published some of your work within Counterpunch, and that has a pretty broad left-leaning audience often. I'm wondering, for people who are encountering your work, are you finding that they're going through the same transformation that you've gone through in terms of being more sympathetic or willing to acknowledge animals as agents by reading these sorts of accounts?
I don't know yet. From the responses I get, I think so. Now, as an educator, as a teacher, it takes time. You need to have a tremendous amount of patience. For me, that's the whole game right there. You know, it could take decades to make impacts on people, but that's, you know, the way it is in the world of education.
Thanks for being here.
Sure.
It's really good to talk with you again. I'll let people know again, the name of your book is Fear of the Animal Planet: The Hidden History of Animal Resistance by Jason Ribal, and it's your last name is spelt with an H, so it's H-R-I-B-A-L. So if people want to check out the book, I would definitely encourage you to do so. And if you can patronize independent bookstores, even better. Jason, thanks so much for being here.
No problem.
Just as a last question, what's your plans next? What are you writing about? Are you hoping to publish more books in this area?
Yeah, I have stuff that I've been on the back burner for a while, and then there's stuff I want to do, and I don't know. We'll see what happens. Usually for me, it's just all kind of odd luck, the way directions I go.
Well, best of luck with whatever you end up doing, and of course we'd love to speak with you again. It's always good to hear about your work. I find it incredibly inspiring. I was actually quite nervous at the beginning of the interview, and I realize it's because I regard your work so highly, and was really just so thrilled to talk with you again.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
That is our show for today. You can join us online at animalvoices.ca or check us out on Facebook. Our new page is getting updated almost daily now with show updates for the following week and links to check out the book that was talked about today and our other shows upcoming in the week. Stay tuned for Charissa with Raw Sugar.